thank you. So thank you for inviting me to give this talk and for making it so that I could still give the talk, even though, I'm now on, UWM has actually closed and banned employees from work-related travel because of the coronavirus. But I'm glad that I can still give this talk. Can you all see my screen now?
Yes. Yeah, we do.
Great. Okay. I apologize for the confusion. I actually just got a new laptop and I rushed and got it out of my office on the last day that the office was still open. So I'm still trying to get used to it. Okay. So yes. So as Will said, I am a member of the NanoGrav Pulsar Timing Array experiment. And so I'm going to be talking about how we can probe supermassive black holes with gravitational waves. Okay. So of course, we're all very familiar with all of the amazing discoveries that have been made by LIGO using gravitational waves to observe the merger of compact binary in spirals. But LIGO is only sensitive to a portion of the gravitational wave spectrum. There are lots of sources that emit at other parts of the gravitational wave spectrum, and we need different types of gravitational wave detectors to observe them in the same way that we need different types of electromagnetic telescopes to observe the entire electromagnetic spectrum. So LIGO is at the high frequency end of the spectrum. In the middle range, we have LISA, the space-based gravitational wave interferometer, which will be sensitive to many types of sources, including extreme mass ratio in spirals and galactic compact binaries. And then at the low frequency end, we have pulsar timing arrays. So by low frequency, I mean order nanohertz gravitational waves. And in this regime, the dominant sources that we expect to see are supermassive black hole binaries, both individual sources and the stochastic background. Okay, so pulsar timing arrays use a method for detecting gravitational waves that is very different from LIGO and LISA. Both LIGO and LISA are interferometers, and they use lasers to detect gravitational waves. Pulsar timing arrays actually use millisecond pulsars to look for changes in the pulse times of arrival caused by the gravitational waves. So the picture that I have in my head is you have all of these pulsars out in space that are almost like clocks, and they're rotating, but they're not rotating evenly because of gravitational waves. And then we are also observing their pulsars on the Earth.
What's up? Our clocks
on the Earth are also...
This is going well. We have 27 participants.
Excuse me, is there a question?
No, that was me, sorry.
Oh, okay. Right, okay. Now you need an array of millisecond pulsars to do this experiment because you saw fluctuations in the times of arrival from just a single pulsar. It would be very hard to convince that it was due to gravitational waves and not something intrinsic to the pulsar. But pulsar timing arrays use a collection of millisecond pulsars that are separated by, thousands of light years. And so they're in their own astrophysical environments. They have their own properties. And because of that, the only thing, or one of the only things that can affect all of them in a correlated fashion are gravitational waves. Okay, so pulsar timing refers to the process where the pulse times of arrival are fit to a timing model. And the timing model has to take into account the spin period and period derivative, the position of the pulsar, the proper motion, parallax, as well as the binary properties. Most millisecond pulsars are in binaries, and that causes the motion of the pulsars in their orbit cause changes to the times of arrival. Okay, we also have to account for dispersion of the pulses due to the interstellar medium. And in particular, what we're interested in is changes in the dispersion measure. There can be both long timescale changes and short timescale changes. Okay, now once you take the times of arrival and you subtract off the predicted times of arrival from your timing model, what you have left over is called the residual. So over on the left, I'm showing the pulsar residuals for one particular pulsar in the nanograv array, J1640 plus 2224. So you can see we've been observing this pulsar for more than 10 years. And over that 10-year period, the pulsar's times of arrival can be measured down to less than a microsecond, bit less than a microsecond. The other thing I want to point out, the third panel, so the one at the bottom, labeled DMX. DMX is the change in the dispersion measure at each observing epoch. So you can see here, the DMX values do show some kind of long timescale trend where it seems to be sweeping upwards. Okay. Now, here I have some panels of pulsar timing residuals. This is from a textbook, The Handbook of Pulsar Astronomy. Right, so up on the top left, this is what you see if you have a good timing solution, right? The residuals are nice and flat and there's no obvious structure. Down in the bottom left, if you have an error in the pulse spin frequency derivative, you're going to see a growing quadratic term in the pulsar residuals. On the top right, this is what you see if there's some error in the pulsar's position. So it's a periodic signal with a period of exactly a year. And then in the bottom right, if you don't take into account the pulsar's proper motion, meaning its motion across the sky, you get a sinusoidal term with a period of a year, but it also has a growing envelope. And these four plots are just to demonstrate that if you observe your pulsar for long enough, you can measure the pulsar's properties to extremely high precision because each astrophysical property will imprint itself on the residuals in a different way. Okay, so once we take into account all of the deterministic things, what's left behind is noise, right? And we split this into two categories, white noise and red noise. White noise includes things that are specific to the telescope, like radiometer noise, and also things that are intrinsic to the pulsar, like pulse jitter, which refers to the fact that the pulses are not being emitted from an infinitely small spot on the surface of the pulsar. And so as you observe the pulsar, the part that's emitting sort of moves back and forth, and that causes the pulse width to be finite. And since it has some finite width, there is some uncertainty in how you define when the pulsar is on or off. The final example of white noise here is DISS, diffractive interstellar scintillation. This is an interstellar medium effect. On the other type of noise we have is red noise, meaning noise that has more power at low frequencies than high frequencies. So spin noise is intrinsic to the pulsar. It's basically how much the pulsar is wobbling. Dispersion measure variations can also show up as red noise. And then the final thing is the gravitational wave background actually appears as red noise. Okay, now there is one common source of noise, and by common, I mean common to all the pulsars, and that's the solar system ephemeris. The pulse TOAs, they're actually measured with respect to the individual observatories, of course, but we have to correct for the fact that the observatories are not an inertial reference frame because the observatories, of course, are on the Earth, which is rotating and orbiting the sun. And so the measured pulse times of arrival are corrected to the times that the pulses would have arrived at the solar system barycenter, which we treat as an inertial reference frame. And we do this using something called the solar system ephemeris, which is a model of all of the planets and moons and major asteroids in the solar system. The one we use is created by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory so that they can send stuff to Mars and Jupiter and the outer planets. But as a side product, you can calculate the solar system barycenter from the ephemeris. Now, in the past, we always treated this as something that could be done exactly, but it turns out that there is enough uncertainty in the position of the barycenter that it affects our gravitational wave results. And so now we have to marginalize over uncertainty in the position of the barycenter using a model called Bayes-Afem, which was developed by Michele Vallisneri and Steve Taylor and others. It primarily comes down to uncertainty in the orbital position of Jupiter. Now, this is improving because of data from the Juno satellite, but we still are including BESA-FEM in our models just to be safe. Okay, the way this shows up is something called the Romer delay, which is the time it takes the pulses to propagate across the Earth's orbit. So in the plot on the bottom right, you can see the Romer difference between different models of the solar system ephemeris. So the numbers, the higher numbers mean they're more recent. So you can see that the difference between these different models is, you know, tens of nanoseconds, which for pulsar timing is quite significant. Now, we discovered this when we were analyzing our 11-year data set. What happened was we started doing these analyses for the stochastic background, and we started seeing significantly different, significant differences in whether our data seemed to show evidence for some common red process, some common signal. So that's what the dotted lines show. If you just analyze the 11-year data set using these four different ephemerides, you get very different posteriors on the gravitational wave amplitude. But if we use BESA-FEM, we're able to bridge all of those results and get the same thing with all ephemerides. And that's sort of a conservative approach. We didn't try to put in any assumptions about which model is the most accurate. We just wanted to be able to bridge the results from the different ephemerides. And I should say that there's actually now a newer one, DE438, which incorporates data from Juno. All of these analyses did not incorporate Juno data, which is partly why the ephemeris was such a big issue. The other reason it was a big issue is that the orbital period of Jupiter is about 12 years, and we had 11 and a half years of data. And so we were able to see almost one complete orbit of Jupiter. That's why we didn't notice it in our earlier analyses. Okay, so the way that I like to think about pulsar timing arrays is that you have your collection of pulsars, and each pulsar has its own timing model, white noise and red noise. And then on top of that, you have the common signals. So we have this common ephemeris uncertainty that we have to marginalize over. And then we also have the gravitational wave signal, which is common to all the pulsars. Okay, so now a few words about my collaboration. So I'm a member of the North American NanoHertz Observatory for Gravitational Waves, or NanoGrav experiment. So we are made up of about 100 scientists from institutions throughout the United States and Canada. We primarily use two telescopes to observe our pulsars, the Arecibo Observatory in Puerto Rico and the Green Bank Telescope in West Virginia. And we've also started incorporating data from CHIME in Canada and from the Very Large Array, which is in New Mexico. Now, there are a number of other pulsar timing array experiments in the world. The three major ones are NanoGrav in North America, the European Pulsar Timing Array, which uses a collection of five radio telescopes in Europe, and then the Parkes Pulsar Timing Array, which uses the Parkes Radio Telescope in Australia. All three of these groups have published data releases and analyzed them for gravitational waves and produced limits on gravitational waves. In addition, there are a couple of what we call emerging PTAs, so groups in South Africa, China, and India who are just getting started with pulsar timing array analyses. And all of these groups collaborate under the umbrella of the International Pulsar Timing Array. The reason we want to do this is because pulsar timing arrays are more sensitive if you have more pulsars and you observe them more frequently. And so by combining all of our data together, we do better than any pulsar timing array can do on its own. The other big advantage is you probably notice, right, that there's only one telescope in the Southern Hemisphere. And so that means, and so Parkes can see pulsars that the other PTAs can't. Now, of course, this is gonna change with the SKA coming online, but for now, Parkes is the only telescope that's capable of seeing one of the best pulsars, JO437, which can only be seen from the Southern Hemisphere. Okay, so our primary sources are supermassive black hole binaries. So these form in galaxy mergers. So we believe that all massive galaxies have a supermassive black hole at their centers. And when two galaxies merge, the two black holes will be brought together through environmental effects to form a binary. Eventually, gravitational wave emission takes over and they will merge. Pulsar timing arrays are sensitive to the slow evolution. So the second panel from the left, this is the part where pulsar timing arrays can see. The merger part can only be seen by LISA. Now, we are sensitive to the offset in the merger. The gravitational wave memory effect can be seen in pulsar timing arrays, but the oscillatory part cannot because it happens at too high frequency for us. Okay, so supermassive black hole binaries are a really interesting topic right now. There are quite a few candidates from electromagnetic observations. So these look at things like AGN light curves, and they use periodicities. They use evidence of periodicities to look for evidence of companion. However, there are a lot of candidates right now, and there are no confirmed binaries. And so this is something that pulsar timing arrays want to do. We want to do multi-messenger astrophysics by doing our own searches of these EM candidates and either putting constraints on their binary properties or confirming that they are binaries. Okay, so this plot shows a model, shows a simulated population of supermassive black hole binaries. Each dot represents a different source, and then the solid line is the sum of all of the sources at a particular frequency. So this line represents the stochastic background. So what you can see is that the stochastic background is louder than any individual source, and this is why we believe that the first source we will detect is the stochastic background, this overall hum of gravitational waves from supermassive black hole binaries. And then after we detect the stochastic background, we will start to detect the loudest few sources. So this is very different from LIGO. LIGO primarily looks at, so far LIGO has been detecting transient sources. So not only are these individual sources, but they're sources that only exist for a short amount of time. With pulsar timing arrays, most of our sources are extremely long-lived, meaning much longer than a human lifespan. And on top of that, the primary source we're looking for is the stochastic background from all of the supermassive black hole binaries in the universe. Okay. So there's a lot of things you can learn about the population of supermassive binary black holes from the stochastic background. If you assume the shape of the spectrum is tied to what's causing the binaries to merge, if you assume that all the binaries in the PTA band are circular and evolve only due to gravitational wave emission, you can show that the gravitational wave strain spectrum is just a power law that goes like frequency to the minus 2/3. If they evolve due to environmental effects at low frequencies, this produces a turnover in the spectrum because environmental effects will accelerate the evolution. And so that depletes the gravitational wave, gravitational wave amplitude at those frequencies. Where the turnover takes place will tell you about the density of material that's producing this turnover, and how much it turns over will tell you what mechanism it is, whether it's stellar hardening or gas dynamics. The amplitude of the stochastic background, which is represented by the green region on the plot, that's tied to the astrophysics of supermassive binary black holes. So the mass, distribution, and also the merger time scale. So, because remember, these sources form in galaxy mergers. Okay. So pulsar timing arrays are still in the regime of placing limits on the stochastic background. There hasn't been a positive detection yet. So this is the most recently published limit on the stochastic background, which comes from the NanoGrav 11-year data set. So the three colored bands represent three different models of the stochastic background. The straight black line is the upper limit you get if you assume that F to the minus 2/3 power law. And the V-shaped curve shows the upper limit you get if you just place an upper limit at each frequency independently. Now, the first thing you probably notice is this huge spike at a frequency of 1/1 year. Oops. So this spike is due to the fact that you have to fit the pulsar positions. Remember that if there's an error in the pulsar positions, it produces a sinusoidal signal with a period of exactly a year. So that means we have we don't have a lot of sensitivity to gravitational waves with a frequency of a year. At the low frequency end, our sensitivity is set by 1/total observation time. So this is a big difference between pulsar timing arrays and other gravitational wave experiments. LIGO and LISA have a set range of frequencies that they're sensitive to. But pulsar timing arrays, the frequency range they can see actually changes as they get more data. And so as just by waiting longer, you're sensitive to lower and lower gravitational wave frequencies. And since we believe the stochastic background has more power at low frequencies, you actually improve your sensitivity to the stochastic background just by waiting longer. At the high frequency end, where the upper limit is going like frequency to the 3/2, that at that end, you're dominated by white noise in your pulsars. So you can do better with, for example, much larger telescopes. Okay, another way you can search for the stochastic background is through something called the optimal statistic, which is specifically looking at the cross correlations between different pulsars. So for this, the stochastic background should produce a characteristic curve called the Hellings and Downs curve for the cross correlated power between two different pulsars, where the correlation coefficient only depends on the angular separation between two pulsars. So that's shown on the left. And on the right, this is from the 11-year data set. I should add that the data points, each point doesn't represent a single pair. The data has been binned into 10-degree bins. So there are many pulsar pairs contributing at each data point. And that's partly why the error bars are so uneven. It's because the distribution of pulsars that we have, we're much more sensitive to some angular separations compared to others. So as you can see, the 11-year data set doesn't show evidence of this, of the Hellings and Downs correlations, because the error bars are just much too large. Okay, but they are significantly smaller than the same plot in the 9-year stochastic paper. Now we're in the process of analyzing our 12.5-year data set for the stochastic background, and we have actually found evidence of some kind of common red process. And it does not seem to be linked to the ephemeris. We are still using BASE-FM to marginalize over uncertainty in the ephemeris, and we're still seeing this common red signal. So this is very exciting. We are not yet at a point, though, where we see the Hellings and Downs correlations. So on the left, this is just the same plot as from the 11-year data set. And on the right, this is a preliminary analysis of the 12.5-year. And there's really no preference between a monopolar correlation, meaning the same correlation for all angular separations, and the quadrupolar that you get from gravitational waves. So all this is just to say that we don't yet have strong evidence of the spatial correlations characteristic of gravitational waves, but there is some kind of common signal in our data. So what we need to do is just gather more data, because we will continually get more sensitive by collecting more data and also by adding more pulsars to the array. Okay, one really interesting thing that we can do in addition to studying the astrophysics of supermassive black hole binaries is we can look for evidence of alternate polarizations of gravitational waves. So in general relativity, there are only two gravitational wave polarizations, but other theories of gravity can allow additional polarizations. And PTAs are particularly good at placing constraints because each line of sight between the Earth and a pulsar gives you another projection of the gravitational wave polarization. LIGO, because LIGO is shaped like an L, LIGO has limited sensitivity to alternative polarizations. The way that we detect the different polarizations is that different polarizations will produce different correlation curves. So instead of the Hellings and Downs curve, you'll get some other relation. Okay, so now I want to talk a bit about individual sources. So after we detect the stochastic background, we expect we'll be able to detect gravitational waves from a handful of individual supermassive binary black holes. Although the exact number is very hard to pin down because it depends a lot on the local population of supermassive binary black holes. Now, the way you can think about the signal from an individual source is that there are two contributions. One is called the Earth term and one is called the pulsar term. The Earth term is basically what the gravitational wave is doing at the Earth. And the pulsar term is what it's doing at the pulsar. Now, the stochastic background also has Earth terms and pulsar terms, but because it's stochastic, you don't know what the pulsar terms are doing, and so it just adds more noise to your data. The only part that's correlated is the Earth term. But for an individual source, you actually can calculate the pulsar terms if you know the Earth term, and then you also know the distance to the pulsars, because then you can calculate the light travel time for the gravitational wave. And so you can calculate what the gravitational wave frequency was at the pulsars. That's the main way it comes in, is that the gravitational wave frequencies at the pulsars are slightly different than the ones at the Earth. And of course, there's also a phase difference. Now, the problem is pulsar distances are not known to within a gravitational wavelength. And so this limits our ability to measure the pulsar term this limits our ability to measure the pulsar terms. The gravitational wavelengths are order like tens of parsecs, I believe, and pulsar distances are mostly known to hundreds of parsecs. So we're off by several orders of magnitude. But if you have a very high chert mass system, it will be evolving very quickly, and this will produce a difference in the frequency, a measurable difference in the frequency between the Earth and the pulsars. And so this would be a way of breaking the degeneracy between the distance to the source and the chert mass. Okay, so the most recent limits on individual sources come again from an analysis of the NanoGrav 11-year data set. So this is a plot of the sky averaged strain upper limit. So for comparison, this plot shows the limits from the 5-year data set, the 9-year data set, and the 11-year data set. And so you can see the significant improvement going from 5 years of data to 11 years of data. But most of the improvement is not due to just having, twice as long of a data span. It's actually due to having more pulsars. The 5-year data set only analyzed 17 pulsars, whereas the 11-year data set analyzed 34. Now you can see this very well, I think, if you look at the sky map on the left. So for this sky map, the gravitational wave strain limits have been recast as limits on the luminosity distance to individual sources for some fixed chert mass, in this case, 10 to the 9 solar masses. Each of the stars indicates the position of a pulsar in the NanoGrav array, and then the diamonds are some candidate supermassive binary black holes. So what you probably notice right away is that there's a very large difference in sensitivity across the sky. At our most sensitive sky location, we can see out to about 120 megaparsecs, but at the least sensitive part of the sky, you can only see out to less than 20 megaparsecs. And that's because you're more sensitive to gravitational wave sources that are close to a pulsar. We just don't have a lot of pulsars on the right-hand side of this plot. Now, the pulsars in this plot, these are the 34 that were used to search for gravitational waves in the 11-year data set. But what you should understand is that we only use them for gravitational wave analyses if they have at least 3 years of data. So there are pulsars in the 11-year data set that just weren't used for gravitational wave analyses yet. So the 12 and a half year paper will use, I think, 45 pulsars. So we'll have a significantly higher number of pulsars. And this plot will have a lot more stars on it. The other thing is, we do all sky surveys to try to fill out our sensitivity and even out the sensitivity between the two parts of the sky. And so if you look at the pulsars that we're actually observing now, all the pulsars we're observing now, there are a lot more sources on this right-hand side of this plot. Now, even though we're not able to detect any gravitational waves yet, we are able to do some interesting astrophysics. So for example, we can put constraints on the chert mass of any potential binaries in the Virgo cluster. And in fact, we can say that there are no supermassive binary black holes in the Virgo cluster with the chert mass above 1.6 times 10 to the 9 solar masses. And in fact, the limit is much lower than that at most gravitational wave frequencies. It's just at like 3 nanohertz, the limit is about 1.6 times 10 to the 9 solar masses. Now for comparison, if you look at the total mass, if you take the total mass of M87 that was measured by the Event Horizon Telescope collaboration, that system, well, if it is a binary, the mass ratio can only be, I think, order of like 6%, okay? So that's another point that I want to make is that gravitational wave searches for supermassive binary black holes are really complementary to electromagnetic observations, because electromagnetic observations are sensitive to the total mass, whereas we're sensitive to the chert mass. And so if you have both of those measurements, you can calculate the masses of the individual black holes. Okay. Another project that we're working on is to put constraints on the candidate supermassive binary black hole in 3C66b. So back in 2003, a group reported that this was a very massive supermassive binary black hole with a total mass of, I think, like a few times 10 to the 10 solar masses. And then a group of pulsar astronomers said, well, if there were a binary that massive, it would be emitting gravitational waves so strongly that we would be able to see it in the residuals of individual pulsars. Forget about using an array, just a single pulsar would be able to see it. And so on the right-hand side, right, you see these plots of residuals. So the bottom is the signal you would see in the residuals if 3C66b were a binary with the total mass of 10 to the 10 solar masses. And then the top is the residuals that you actually see. This is for one particular pulsar, B1855 plus 09. And these are on the same scale. So you can see that there's clearly no signal like this in B1855. And based on this work, the group that originally reported this binary went back and revised their mass estimates for this candidate. I should add that this candidate is, well, it's a little, it's So the reported period of the binary is very close to a year. And anything in astrophysics with a period of a year is immediately kind of suspect, because a lot of times that's just caused by the Earth, by the Earth's motion around the sun. The mass has been revised, and we are now sensitive enough to put new constraints on this candidate using the 11-year data set. And this paper will be out relatively soon. It's being led by Caitlin Witt, who is a graduate student at West Virginia University. Another thing we can do is do sort of statistical multi-messenger astrophysics by putting constraints on galaxy merger rates within the local universe. So this is a project being led by Maria Carisi, who is a postdoc at Caltech. And what we're doing is using a catalog of supermassive black hole masses, and then doing gravitational wave searches at those sky locations. And from that, putting constraints on the mass ratio of any potential binaries. Now, if the two galaxies undergo a major merger, that means that the mass ratio of the resulting binary should be greater than 0.25. And so if the mass ratio limit is less than 0.25, you can say that that galaxy has not undergone a major merger over some time scale. Okay, so finally, I want to finish by talking a little bit about the millisecond pulsars themselves. One of the things I like most about working in pulsar timing arrays is that every part of our experiment is more astrophysics. The pulsars themselves are very interesting objects. And our data set is very valuable for the study of compact objects, I mean, independent of what we're able to do for gravitational waves. So millisecond pulsars are a distinct population of pulsars. They have lower spin periods and also lower spin period derivatives than conventional pulsars. The lower spin period derivatives points to the fact that they have weaker magnetic fields. And also most of them are found in binaries with a stellar remnant companion. And these point to how we believe millisecond pulsars form. We believe that they form via accretion in an X-ray binary. So millisecond pulsars began their lives as normal pulsars. And then at some point, when their companion became a red giant, the companion started dumping mass on the pulsar, causing it to gain angular momentum and spin up. Okay. Now, since most millisecond pulsars have companions, for some of them, you can measure a relativistic time delay called the Shapiro delay, which is caused by the pulses propagating close to the companion. Okay, so the Shapiro delay is proportional to the mass of the companion, and it also depends on the inclination of the orbit. So this you can't observe the Shapiro delay for all binaries. The binary has to be oriented just so. Now, if you can measure the mass of the companion this way, you can also measure the mass of the pulsar using the binary mass function. So all the quantities on the left-hand side of this bottom equation can be measured very, very precisely from pulsar timing. So the spin period of the the orbital period of the binary, and also the projected semi-major axis of the binary can be measured to very high precision. The right-hand side, the quantities over there can't be measured as precisely because they come from the Shapiro delay, and the Shapiro delay is difficult to measure. Okay, so the most recent really exciting Shapiro delay measurement came from Thankful Cromartie, Emmanuel Fonseca, and others. It was published in Nature Astronomy because this particular system may be the most massive known pulsar. I say maybe because the uncertainty on the pulsar mass is larger than on some of the other massive pulsar masses. But they measured this particular pulsar's mass as 2.1, as about 2.1 solar masses. Right. So on the right-hand side, I'm showing the pulsar timing residuals for this particular pulsar, J0740 plus 6620. And in the bottom panel, you see the full Shapiro delay. In order to make this precise measurement, they actually had to get targeted observations so that they could observe the pulsar when the Shapiro delay was at its maximum. Because you can see from this plot, from this bottom plot on the right, that the Shapiro delay signal has, there's this very narrow period of time where the signal is very large and the rest of the time the signal is much smaller. So if you want to measure Shapiro delay, you really need to measure it at this peak. Right. Now, massive neutron stars are really interesting for studying neutron star equations of state, because any equation of state needs to be able to produce a neutron star mass as massive as the most massive pulsar. Okay, so this plot is showing a number of different neutron star equations of state, and then there are three horizontal lines indicating the masses of the three most massive neutron stars, J0740, J0348, and J1614. All of them are millisecond pulsars, and all of them have white dwarf companions. And the reason is that millisecond pulsars tend to be more massive than regular neutron stars because they underwent this accretion process. So they're not at the mass they were born at. They gained mass during this accretion process. Okay, now there's a lot of interesting work being done right now on neutron star equations of state, both theoretical and observational. So things like the LIGO mergers and the X-ray telescope NICER are able to measure the mass and radius of neutron stars. So that allows you to put points on this plot. But these measurements of really massive neutron stars give you a limit that all of the equations of state have to be able to go up to. Okay, so in conclusion, pulsar timing arrays are sensitive to a part of the gravitational wave spectrum that's not accessible using any other method. Well, actually, that's not true. This low frequency part of the spectrum can also be observed using astrometry like Gaia. The difference is that pulsar timing array sensitivity is continually improving, whereas since Gaia had a set time span, its sensitivity is just set at this point. And then the other thing is, if you really look at the two curves, Gaia is, even though the curves overlap, Gaia is more sensitive at the high frequency part, whereas PTAs are more sensitive at the low frequency part. So the two experiments do overlap in sensitivity, but they are better in different regimes. Now, pulsar timing arrays have not yet made a positive detection of gravitational waves, but we expect them to detect gravitational waves within the next several years. First, the stochastic background, and then gravitational waves from individual sources. But already, PTAs are putting interesting constraints on the astrophysical properties of nearby supermassive binary black holes. And we are starting to be able to put constraints on things like the galaxy merger rate within the local universe. And sort of as a bonus, as we're taking all this data to detect gravitational waves, we're also learning a lot about the pulsars themselves. In particular, we can use data from pulsar timing arrays to study the neutron star equation of state and binary evolution. Thank you.
Great, thanks.
Thank you, Sarah, for that very nice talk. So I guess, and I'll take questions. So if people can hit the little raise hand button I'll call on people so we don't all speak at the same time. And maybe while people are finding that button, I'll go ahead and ask a question myself. You had that one slide where you were telling us about this intriguing result where it looked like there was a common red component to the signal. And one possibility is that it is the stochastic gravitational wave signal. You were saying that you didn't think it was this ephemeris measurement because you're still marginalizing over that. So is there an alternative, like non-gravitational wave source of noise that you're most concerned about?
Yes, the source of noise that we talk about the most now is the interstellar medium. So there is a common part of the interstellar medium. I guess it's not really the interstellar medium, but the solar wind is also common to all the pulsars, right? All of the pulses have to propagate through the solar system, which is affected by the solar wind. And for quite a few of the pulsars, at certain times of the year, the pulses have to go very close to the sun. So that is a common source of noise to all of them. The other thing to keep in mind is that our sensitivity is dominated by a handful of pulsars. And so even if they're probing different regions of the interstellar medium, if they're all showing some excess low frequency noise, that can look like a common signal, even though it's not actually common to all the pulsars. So we have a few different tests that we do. One of them is something called a dropout analysis, where you're really quantifying how much support there is for the common signal in each individual pulsar. And what you want is there to be support in as many pulsars as possible, and not have it just be coming from one or two. The other thing is it's very important to keep looking for these cross correlations. The cross correlations, as far as I know, there's no source of noise that could produce this exact cross correlation pattern. And so that's sort of the smoking gun that you've detected the stochastic background. But as I showed in this plot, you can't yet distinguish between the Hellings and Downs correlations and just a plain monopolar correlations. They both fit the data equally well. So we really need to wait for the significance of the cross correlations to grow.
Okay, thank you, Sarah. So I see that Louise has his hands raised. So go ahead, Louise.
Oh, is he muted?
Louise, we can't hear you if you're...
Sorry, I was muted. So, quick question. So you mentioned at the very beginning of your talk that you are using also chime information, but perhaps I'm misremembering, but I kind of thought that you needed some number of years before a pulsar can help you out. So how are you using chime information?
Chime is really, so first of all, the pulsars, we're not observing new pulsars with chime. We're observing the same pulsars that we already observe, but getting extra data from chime on them. And because chime can monitor pulsars every single day, you can get really, really good measurements of small scale fluctuations in the interstellar medium. Yeah, because you're monitoring them every day.
Oh, I see. That's pretty good. So, what do you think is the impact of the chime that could be? I mean, is it gonna significantly let you reduce the error budget estimate, or in what fashion? I mean, whatever is in the can from early days where you didn't know much, but could you think of using chime to kind of extrapolate backwards in time to try and understand how you could perhaps clean further the years where you didn't have chime at your disposal?
So I don't think we can do that. I don't think we can, you know, use it to improve the measurement of dispersion in the past. Where what it's really going to do is help our high frequency sensitivity up here, right? Because up here we're dominated by white noise, and short time scale fluctuations in the interstellar medium are white noise. And so this is going to lower that white noise level. Now, if you look at this plot, you might be thinking, okay, but most of the power in the stochastic background is at low frequencies, so it's not that helpful, which is true. But lowering the amount of white noise is really helpful for measuring individual sources, because there are quite a few sources that are in this. Sorry, can you see my pointer?
No, but if, you could if you, I think you have to, where do you have to click? Somewhere.
Well, I'll just sort of describe it. So if you look at this the lowest point in this V, right? And then you look a little bit to the right, in this region between the lowest point and the 1 year spike, there tend to be a good number of individual sources that we could detect. And so by lowering the white noise, you'll be able to detect them better. Yeah, so I think Chime will be really helpful for detecting individual sources. The other thing is, we have a number of people in our group who actually use pulsars to study the interstellar medium. Like, the pulsars are the tools for studying the interstellar medium. And so they're very excited about data from Chime just for that purpose.
All right, thank you.
Anna, do you have a question?
Hi, Sarah, how's it going?
Hi.
I remember you talking about this a little at Midwest Relativity, and one of your slides showed it as well. But that whole idea about a binary black hole, that it would first be seen in pulsar timing array and then later in LISA. But you were saying there hasn't been much done on the idea of multiband because maybe the time is too long.
Yes. So I can show this again with the same plot. Right. So any individual source that we see close to this lowest point, close to this most sensitive point, which we refer to as the bucket. So if the individual source is near the bucket, it would take like hundreds of years for it to reach LISA. But if we can detect it at the high frequency end, then we might be able to detect it in LISA in only like a few decades. So still too long for like a PhD student, but you could observe both within your lifetime. So that's another reason why it would be great if we could lower our sensitivity at high frequencies.
Cool, thanks.
Yeah, but it what we can do with LISA is more of a statistical study. The sources that we observe will eventually merge in LISA, and the sources that LISA observes will have at one point in the past been in our band. And so we can, I think we should be able to do some kind of statistical multi-messenger or multi-band astronomy.
Any other questions? Maybe I'll take the advantage to ask one more question while you're on this plot. So can you, I mean, so presumably, like, based on this plot, you can, you know, rule out some specific elements of these models of how often and like with what eccentricities and so forth supermassive black holes merge. Could you say a little bit about the difference between the optimistic model versus the moderate and pessimistic ones?
Right. So the thing we're most sensitive to right now is just the amplitude. We don't really have sensitivity to the shape of the curve yet. And so we're sensitive to all those, all of the elements that go into basically calculating how many of these binaries should there be. So things like the mass distribution of supermassive black holes and the merger rate. And the optimistic model assumes that supermassive black hole masses are on the high end of predictions. And it also assumes that galaxy mergers happen, again, at sort of the high end of what's predicted. And then the pessimistic model is the opposite. You're assuming that supermassive black hole masses are on the low end of what's predicted, and that mergers happen at a lower rate. Those are the main ingredients.
And just as a follow-up on, I think, like one or two slides previous, you had this one component that changed the low frequency part where it said gravitational wave absorption.
Okay, yes. Yeah. So this is a pretty old slide. This is actually from before LIGO detected gravitational waves. I think gravitational wave absorption was some theory that the reason LIGO hadn't seen anything yet was because gravitational waves, it had something to do with the way gravitational waves were propagating through space, but it was some modified theory of gravity. And I don't think that this theory is still circulating. So I should actually probably cover that up.
Okay, thanks. I see Juan has a question.
So Sarah, you have a slide discussing measuring actual polarizations of gravitational waves. Can you measure all six polarizations?
Yes, we are sensitive to all six of these polarizations. So we can measure alternative polarizations both by measuring the stochastic background and from measuring individual sources. And most of this work has been done, or there are two recent papers on this by Neil Cornish and Logan O'Bairn, who was Neil's PhD student. For individual sources, you can actually do very well if you happen to have a source that is very close to a pulsar. There's an enhanced response to pulsars to, I can't remember offhand which polarization, but for one of the polarizations, there is a very, it has a very sharp response function. So if the pulsar and the source are aligned just right, you would be able to put very strong constraints or measure very precisely this particular polarization.
So normally you would think, right, like the signal from different polarizations could be degenerate if you don't have enough pulsars or you don't have enough events. I guess what I'm asking is how many, let's say if you use individual sources to measure polarization, how many of these events do you need to be able to identify all six polarizations?
That's a really good question. That's something that I'm actually hoping to work on with a student. So the answer is that we don't know. We haven't done those calculations, or we haven't done simulations to show that. Right. So what Logan did was he looked at how well we can recover different, or what kind of constraints we can put on different polarizations for an individual source. But I'm not sure if what he did really answers your question. For the stochastic background, I've thought about this one a little bit more. Because we have a finite number of pulsars, and because some of the pulsars are more sensitive than others, we don't have a perfect ability to distinguish between these different cross-correlation patterns. I think that's a really interesting project to see basically how well we can distinguish between them.
Okay, thanks.
And Laura, I see you have a question.
Thanks, Sarah, for the talk. I saw this paper recently on the archive by Gallat and Contaldi about what they call geodesic noise in PTAs. I was wondering if you, I didn't read beyond the abstract, but I was wondering if you had something to say about it.
I don't. I know the paper you're talking about, and I have downloaded it, and I have not looked at it yet. I'm sorry.
No problem.
Any final questions? Okay. If not, let's thank Sarah again. So thanks for the nice talk.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you for having me.